As an introduction, this presentation is adapted from a draft chapter for a book manuscript that was in progress at the time of conference submissions. The book has since been published under the title Inside Evangelicalism, The Culture of Conservative White Christianity. Now, I begin. Women are suited to a role, and men are suited to a role. It's a design God built into His creation, the pastor stated. This is all to adorn the gospel message by how we put our doctrine into practice. In this way, he said, traditional gendering is like selling a house. It's not just the information, but how you stage it. Our lives stage the gospel where people can see it. The message that Sunday evening was part of a weekly series on the marks of an effective church. That night's sermon, titled Adorning the Gospel, took its text from the book of Titus, which instructs the young women to be keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. At the time, I was in my first year observing Riverside Bible Church, not its real name. In 3 years of field work, I found that an essentialist view of gender differences was woven into congregational life. As a professing evangelical who chose to do ethnography in my own culture, I could discern its taken-for-granted meanings and assumptions. Thus, the accepted address forms men and ladies encoded a gendered social hierarchy. The church's regular activity for men was called the monthly men's prayer breakfast and held on Saturday when all men could attend. In contrast, the weekly activity for women was called the ladies' Bible study and held Tuesday morning so that women employed full-time outside the home were excluded. Topics for the ladies' Bible study in that first year were studies of the book of Titus, which admonishes women to be keepers at home, and the book of Ruth about a woman who was seen as the archetype of the faithful wife redeemed through marriage. 9 times that year, bridal and baby showers were announced in the weekly church bulletin and illustrated with feminine clip art as tacitly women-only events. At the end of the year, weekly bulletins called for nominations of elders from among, quote, men who you feel are gifted to serve the church body in these positions, unquote. At the same time, bulletins called for volunteers to serve in women's ministries and, quote, help to decorate the church on special Sundays, plan meals for people who are ill, prepare communion, etc. Later bulletins announce, quote, there will be a meeting of the social committee. All ladies of the church are invited to come and help set up and organize church activities. When potluck suppers were announced by a male elder from the Sunday morning pulpit, he invariably charged the women with some variation on, ladies, bring your best dishes, and then a charge to clean up the kitchen afterward. Evangelical culture interprets the Bible as ordaining a hierarchical structure in the world which God intentionally created. The orderliness of God's creation thus extends to relationships between men and women, parents and children, and so on. As one study concluded after surveying 2,600 evangelicals and interviewing 300 more, quote, most evangelicals are quite comfortable with the idea that the husband should be the head of the family. They believe the Bible teaches this, and they very much want to take it seriously, unquote. Since the 1990s, evangelical anti-feminism has been clothed as complementarianism. Male headship is legitimated through a rhetoric in which men and women are held to be spiritually equal, but are designed by God to play functionally different roles that complement each other. In my recent book, I combine ethnographic and autoethnographic research. To begin, I describe sermons at Riverside Bible Church and their interpretation as managerial discourses. That is, I analyzed sermons in the same light as corporate managers who must inculcate in their employees a strong identification with the organization and its corporate values. A sermon such as Adorning the Gospel and its admonition to practice traditional gender roles as biblical imperatives thus became the pastor's means to regulate church members' organizational identifications and foster their internalization of gender essentialist values. My own experience of gendering in evangelical culture reflects a phenomenon common among all human cultures, inertia and fluidity. The culture of conservative Christianity may seem monolithically patriarchal to outsiders, yet behind this inertia also lies some fluidity. My wife and I met at a single adult Bible study in the late 1970s and married in the early 1980s. When we were dating and then newlyweds, evangelical culture was reacting to the sexual revolution of the 1960s and women's liberation movement of the 1970s. The battle over the Equal Rights Amendment was top of mind. The general sense among evangelicals was dismay. Why are we pushing women into the workforce and mothers out of the home? Why are we devaluing motherhood? So pastors and spiritual leaders counseled young couples, be a witness, rely on one income, and trust God for your finances. My wife and I took that to heart. When our first child arrived, she chose to quit her job out of a sincere desire to stay home. It's a lifestyle that we freely chose and have lived ever since. But when we were a young couple, the expectation in church was that the pastor's wife should set the example. If she worked outside the home, that was unusual and cause for quiet remarks. She was expected to be the de facto head of women's ministries, essentially an unpaid staff member. The example of our own pastor's wife offered encouragement from an older woman to whom my wife could look up. In the 1980s, being a stay-at-home mom with two young children was difficult. My wife was the only mother for blocks around who was at home during the day. Play dates with other children were impractical. And my wife babysat far more than others babysat for her. Then, too, this was before cell phones. Workplaces strictly prohibited employees from using work phones for personal calls. So as an evangelical woman, my wife was on her own with our house and children, morning to evening, 10 hours a day. In recent years, we've talked it over and have no regrets. But we've noticed how male headship has changed in practice over the decades. As two-income households became the American norm, so too in evangelical culture. In all but one of the past 5 churches I've attended, the pastor's wife worked outside the home, though in traditionally female occupations of secretary or teacher. And in my past 3 churches, the pastor's wife made no pretense of being a leader in women's ministries or really any more involved than other women. Recently, my wife and I wryly noted a sermon by our pastor. Whether you wives decide to stay home or work, he declared, if you and your husband are agreed, then own your decision and don't apologize for it. 40 years ago, our pastor would never have said this. Of course, that our current pastor had to say this at all speaks to the ongoing influence of patriarchal ideology. I have my own interpretation. With the rise of the religious right in the 1970s and 80s as a reaction to changing sexual mores, evangelicals pushed back against women's lib. By the 1990s, however, 2-income households were the norm. Evangelical couples, swayed by the rising cost of living and rising economic expectations, heard the conventional wisdom that one income was no longer feasible, so they joined the 2-income norm. As a fig leaf, the doctrine of complementarianism arose in just that moment and rapidly became the default. The formula that men and women are of equal spiritual worth but differently designed by God to complement one another was easily grasped, countered the threat posed by evangelical feminists, and gave pastors and couples a formula to maintain a rhetorical commitment to male headship amidst the daily exceptions of modern family life. That rhetorical commitment is all around the evangelical church that I attended until recently. The pastoral staff and deacons are all men, the secretarial staff all women. A woman has never spoken from the pulpit. Marriage is the default relationship. There is no singles group. Yet there are no couples activities. Bible studies are segregated by sex. Women's studies use books by popular evangelical women authors about evangelical women's concerns. In one recent choice, titled Adorned, Living Out the Beauty of the Gospel Together, a popular evangelical woman radio host counseled wives on godly submission to their husbands. The title Adorned, rendered on the front cover in flowing feminine cursive script, is taken from 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, which teaches, "Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands." A few years ago, I suggested in a mixed group that women might read a non-Christian book that challenges their beliefs and discuss how scriptural principles could address those challenges. The suggestion was met with puzzled looks and stony silence. My suggestion was self-evidently irrational. In the essentialist gender ideology of conservative Christian culture, men by nature are strong and stoic, women relational and emotional. In consequence, few activities of the church are organized for men, while several regular events are held each month for women, including a craft night. Meanwhile, women gravitate toward nursery duty, men toward coaching and refereeing the church's youth football and soccer outreaches. Women outnumber men in the choir 4-1, though the director is a man. Sunday best applies only to women, who tend toward dressy casual and thus discipline their bodies. Men, however, come to worship in jeans and casual shirts or tees, tucked in or not. The tacit message seems clear. Men are leaders, strong to stand alone. Women need relationships and outlets to express their emotional nature through nurturing, creative crafts, music, and personal appearance. In summary, real evangelical men don't sing. One Sunday evening, while my wife was discussing Adorned with her women's Bible study group, my men's group watched a video hosted by the recent past president of the Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. His presentation was titled Stay-at-Home Moms and argued that a biblical worldview must embrace complementarianism. Knowing the lesson titled in advance, I requested time at the start of the session to distribute a handout. The sheet reproduced arguments from scholars who identify as evangelical feminists. Using the same methods of Bible interpretation as conservative scholars, they argue that the Bible passages cited by complementarians in fact lead to an egalitarian view. For example, that the Hebrew word in the Genesis creation account translated as helpmate actually means ally. How do you avoid the conclusion, I asked the men, that our video is supported only by proof texting, that the conclusion determines the interpretation rather than the other way around? One man stated that only the complementarian position is biblical and thus is not proof texting. The leader then referred to my handout and asked me, "Is this what you believe?" His facial expression suggested that an affirmative answer would disqualify me as a biblical Christian. After the video was shown, I explained the meaning of gender essentialism, the view that men and women differ in their essence, and the arguments that are made to rebut that view. All the men concurred with the video's claim that, by God's design, women are emotional by nature and men are not. The group consensus was forcefully expressed by one man who stated, "Feminism isn't biblical." However, recent books by evangelical women scholars have put complementarianism under the microscope and generated much discussion. Amy Bird's Recovering from Biblical Manhood and Womanhood describes the personal impact of the doctrine. Beth Allison Barr's The Making of Biblical Womanhood ranges across Christian history to argue how the subjugation of women became gospel truth, not as a natural result of timeless Bible interpretation, but through social developments set in motion by the Protestant Reformation. Christian Cobes de Mays' Jesus and John Wayne lays out in detail how white American evangelicals spent decades making an idol out of rugged masculinity and Christian nationalism. I lived through most of the history that she recounts and remember what she describes. DeMay contends that white evangelical worship of masculinity corrupted a faith and fractured a nation. Given how this history paved the evangelical road to Donald Trump's, DeMay's thesis must be accepted. On reading Bird and Barr, I had to consider the cost to many evangelical women of a gender ideology that's grown increasingly hardline as leaders feel threatened from within and without. On reading DeMay, I had to consider the cost of this ideology to evangelicalism itself. And as an evangelical man, I had to consider whether complementarianism has cost evangelical men. Being schooled in manly stoicism, pushed into manly interests, has a cost. How many evangelical men have never shed tears of joy or sorrow with a wife or child, never discovered a talent for singing, music, art, creative writing, never got so absorbed in a good book that they didn't want it to end, or have felt the pressure to always be in control, always be the one who fixes the car, fixes the toilet, fixes every problem? Then, too, evangelical men have missed out on what evangelical women's voices and perspectives could teach us. More worrisome, power over others deemed weaker than yourself is intoxicating and corrupting. Who can doubt that being put in church environments where men hold power over women, where male headship is justified by holy writ, has created conditions for some men to abuse that power? In 2019, investigative journalists uncovered more than 400 Southern Baptist pastors, deacons, and youth leaders who victimized more than 700 women and girls going back more than 20 years, and Baptist leaders covered it up. And of the 10 churches in 4 regions of the country that I've attended since my conversion as a college student, pastors of 2 were forced out for inappropriate conduct. That's 20%. If my unscientific sample suggests that sexual misconduct approaches anywhere near 1 in 5 evangelical churches, that is staggering. Has evangelicalism's rugged masculinity exacted a cost for me personally? In honesty, I don't see myself as a hardline complementarian. I didn't grow up in an evangelical home. Gender roles were just what my parents did, like all the other parents we knew. I lived in a major East Coast city. The only hunting I ever did was hunting for a place to park, an important survival skill where I grew up. My early career was a struggle, not a power trip. Budgeting on one income was a cooperative effort that depended as much on my wife as on me. By marrying and having a family early, that's what young people did in our day, we all grew up together. I had lots of energy and love to spend it with my children, and I believed that my New Testament responsibility to sacrificially love my wife always came first. Then, too, we relocated multiple times. Exposure to many churches meant that I never bought into one way of doing things. Instead, I frequently saw the damage done by top-down leadership. Before my second career in academe, I spent 2 decades in the employ of large evangelical parachurch ministries. Daily exposure demystified for me the celebrated leaders of these organizations as charismatic entrepreneurs with little appetite or acumen for interpersonal skills and servant leadership. Then later, my entry into academe and training as an ethnographer gave me a counterweight to my participation in evangelical culture, plus the tools to mentally step back and assess what goes on in my faith community. As an academic, a vital part of my work is scholarly exchange. Not long ago, I attended a conference and participated in a paper session on gender and evangelicals. I presented my paper on evangelicals, and 3 colleagues presented theirs. We all learn from each other. And yet, as I've heard at many conferences over the years, my academic colleagues mocked evangelicals as Ozzie and Harriet stereotypes, hopelessly retrograde and oppressive in their gender ideology and sexual ethics. I had to admit that white evangelicals' penchant for judging others makes them ripe targets to be judged in turn. But is mutual stereotyping and disparagement the only path? If the freedom to choose is a value that we all can share, and if evangelicals must better understand rather than simply dismiss their neighbors' choices, can the choices that conservative Christian women and men may freely make about gender as expressions of their faith also be understood and respected? My wife and I are baby boomers. We were born in the 1950s, children in the 1960s, young adults in the 1970s. Our fathers lived the post-war social contract, trading loyalty to their employers for job security so that our mothers could stay home. We lived in tidy middle-class post-war suburbs. As products of our time, a one-income suburban lifestyle is what we know. In an earlier or later generation, we might have chosen differently. But traditional gender roles are comfortable for us. They are what we freely chose and what we both mutually desired for living out our faith. On the one hand, our experience of evangelical culture has turned us away from rigid, inflexible complementarianism, and recently to join an evangelical denomination that ordains women. Granted, if a young couple came to us for an opinion, we would share our lifestyle in a positive light. But we would not weaponize our choice to judge anyone, and by the same token, we would hope that others would not judge us. That kind of mutual respect seems a good place to begin dialogue and dial down the culture wars.